Welcome to episode one of Journey Makers, the podcast exploring not just what the future looks like, but how we're going to get there. In each episode, we aim to tackle one of the big questions facing the future of mobility. One question, just one, but a big one, every month. This month, we're looking at policy, and the question we're asking is, how do you legislate for driverless cars? At the heart of this issue is exactly how connected and autonomous vehicles can and will be regulated and legislated for. It's probably worth mentioning at this point that if you hear the word CAV at any point, that's an acronym and it stands for Connected and Autonomous Vehicle. Essentially, it's what us regular folk would refer to as a driverless car. And as for the reason that we wanted to start with this meaty topic, how to legislate for driverless cars, well, chances are that it's policy that will ultimately govern what the future of driverless cars looks like in the UK. And as you'll be hearing later on in this episode, the rules and regulations that we put in place today could still be in use hundreds of years from now. The UK government has stated its position on CAV. It is supportive of the technology, and it's backed us up with funding for a number of research, development, demonstration and deployment projects. In 2015, the government established its Centre for Connected and Autonomous Vehicles. The CCAV, as it's known, is a joint policy unit and works across government departments. Its ultimate aim is to make the UK a premier development location for connected and autonomous vehicles. Sounds straightforward enough, right? Well, there's been plenty of progress in the area over the past 2 years, including a number of successful trials, but much of the near future is still filled with unknowns. Each new test or research project has the potential to throw up fresh questions about how CAV will be regulated and legislated for. And of course, we've been here before. In the 1860s and 70s, a series of parliamentary acts were introduced. The Locomotive Acts of 1861, 65 and 78 were the government's attempts at regulating the use of mechanically propelled vehicles on British public highways. And they were not great. They came to be known as the Red Flag Acts after it was written into law that road vehicles hauling multiple wagons should be preceded by a man blowing a horn and waving a red flag. These draconian acts effectively halted development of road automobiles in the UK for the remainder of the century, as engineers chose to focus on railway locomotives instead. However, they did serve some more positive purposes too. They formalised many road concepts that still exist today, such as vehicle registration, registration plates, speed limits and more. Fast forward 100 or so years, and our governing bodies are faced with a similarly mountainous challenge. How do you legislate for the future of mobility? And not just the near future, but a future that extends far beyond your own lifetime. Well, the UK's politicians and legal bods are already grappling with this very challenge. The Law Commission is currently undertaking a far-reaching review of the UK's legal framework for automated vehicles. Last year, the UK Chancellor, Philip Hammond, said he wanted to see genuine driverless vehicles in use on Britain's roads by 2021. And more recently, London-based taxi firm Addison Lee pledged to have self-driving cabs in the capital by that same year. So if you've not done the maths already, that leaves us around 3 years to have everything in place. All of this sets us up nicely for the big question we're tackling in this episode. Just how can policy and legislation be adapted to include connected and autonomous vehicles? Helping us navigate our way to an answer this month is a broadcast of experts. We have a lawyer.
My name is Ben Gardner. I'm an associate working at international law firm Pinsent Masons. My particular specialisms lie in the fields of commercial law and emerging technologies.
An analyst.
So my name is Matthew Howitt and I'm the founder and principal analyst at the research firm Assembly.
And an expert in automotive R&D.
My name is Richard Curran. I'm the director here at TRL for our academy. I'm responsible for all of our future R&D, really making sure that TRL is going to remain relevant in the space of mobility and transport in the next 5 and 10 years.
They've all got their own takes on the future of CAV policy, so it's probably about time we found out what they are. lawyer, Ben Gardner, the connection with cars runs deep.
Well, I'm obviously a born and bred Brummie, and the automotive sector has always been a very important element of our city. I think the automotive sector over the next 5 to 10 years is going to see more change than it has in the last 50.
So how do we legislate for that?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I suppose the immediate answer is that the current legal frameworks aren't really drafted with the future types of technology and mobility services in mind. Current legislation, some of it that relates to the use of highways and road traffic legislation, dates back to the 1800s. It references the use of horse and carts, for example, so that there's a clear disparity between legislation that currently applies and how we're currently operating the road network. And that disparity is only going to get wider as we move towards new forms of transport. So that there are certain, when we think about maybe the automated pods that we may see being operated in public spaces in the future, whether that's to deliver products or people, there are pieces of legislation out there that do not allow those types of transport to actually be used. So, for example, that's why we saw the Segway never really take off in the UK, because it can't technically be used on pavements, it can't technically be used on roads. So how are we going to try and introduce these new forms of transport into the kind of UK road network in a way that is safe but also compatible with current existing legislation? So I think that future legislation should really look to try and address some of these obstacles, uncertainties and grey areas in order to give businesses and the wider range of stakeholders in the mobility sector the confidence that they need to really try and invest in all of these new forms of transport that we're likely to see.
On the 3rd of September 1967, traffic in Sweden was switched overnight from driving on the left-hand side of the road to the right. Known as H-Day, the H stands for Höga Traffic, which means right traffic in Swedish, the transition was the largest logistical event in Sweden's history. Part of the reason for the change was that all of Sweden's neighbours drove on the right, and about 90% of Swedes drove left-hand drive vehicles. And despite the high stakes, it was considered to be a great success. Traffic accidents actually dropped as a result of the change. But this isn't exactly how Ben sees the adoptions of driverless cars happening.
I think it will inevitably have to be a gradual rollout, and the government has actually set up a standalone department, which is called the Centre for Connected and Autonomous Vehicles. And they've come out as saying that they are going to have a rolling programme of reform. It will be gradual. We don't quite understand how the technology works and whether it's fully matured yet. So inevitably, the law will need to track the pace of change of the technology, and as it starts to actually mature, only then will it be necessary to start introducing those changes to legislation that set out how it can be used. And until we get to that stage, I think it's a case of identifying those obstacles, trying to formulate what those future frameworks might look like, but at the same time tracking the technology and slowly but surely drip feeding the necessary changes, the necessary new bits of legislation into wider UK law to make sure that we are not having that kind of drop dead flicking of a switch, because I don't think that will quite work. And again, query whether it could lead to lots of crashes or lots of misunderstandings as to how different types of transport can be used, where and at what time.
Part of the issue that legislators face is that introducing new laws is a much slower process than developing new technology. Ben argues that policymakers are struggling to keep up and that perhaps something should be done about this.
Well, I think at the moment, introducing new laws or changing existing ones is a very lengthy and laborious process with kind of readings happening in the Houses of Commons and the Houses of Lords, and legislation going back and forth, and many people wanting to have their input and their say. But what we might ultimately need is to put in place maybe a mechanism by which the law can be a bit more agile and can keep up with the pace of change of technology a bit more readily. So it's not something that we've seen introduced to date, but there would be nothing to say that the government couldn't introduce like a Future Technologies Act or something like that that actually enabled short, sharp changes to be made to the law that removed obstacles, removed grey areas for a short or medium period of time to enable testing or certain use cases to be undertaken and carried out, and then that would enable us to identify where longer term changes might be needed and what they might look like.
It's an interesting prospect. In the case of CAV, however, some people argue that lawmakers need to think far beyond the bounds of their own countries. Going back to Sweden's H-Day, it made sense for Sweden to have a policy that matched the other countries in the region. Richard Kjørdan from the Transport Research Laboratory has a global vision for CAV policy, and his organisation has plenty of experience in the field too.
TRL is the UK's Transport Research Laboratory. We were formed in 1933, and our first automated vehicle trials were in the 1950s. So we started looking at automated vehicles a long time ago. And then through into the 60s, we had vehicles running around our track in automated or more automated than perhaps autonomous modes, following lines in the road service. But we even had buses that were operating without drivers back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. My vision is for a global policy for minimum safety standards for vehicles. So in a way that we have now for crashworthiness, there's sort of an accepted range of tests that you would have a vehicle to pass to in the event of a collision to protect the occupants. You could imagine to allow fair and good trade that vehicles would have to be, automated vehicles would have to be made with an understanding of what that minimum level of safety performance would be. What you could then find is then on top of that, either national or local authorities may require certain additional standards. So if you were to operate, for example, if you wanted to operate a automated or self-driving taxi service in a city somewhere in the UK, that city may have its standards around what sort of vehicles could be used and what sort of operation they could follow. For example, perhaps the sort of roads they could go on or the sort of speeds they could operate at or in what environments, on top of the safety regulation of that vehicle.
Richard accepts that this vision is pretty ambitious. He says it won't necessarily make things easier for people introducing new vehicles into the market. In many ways, the real difficulty won't be in developing the technology itself, but in making sure it's compliant.
So there's going to be layers to these things because there's so many stakeholders, from national governments giving licensing for them to operate, to regional authorities perhaps giving licensing to the operators' businesses or to be allowed onto their streets. So it's going to be quite a challenge for anybody bringing any product to the marketplace to make sure that what they're bringing is going to be acceptable to all these different potential stakeholders, to make sure they can get it out there to enough people to realise the benefits of that product, that people will use it, that it can generate income.
This brings us to another interesting point. The word policy has its roots in the ancient Greek word polis for city. Polis then becomes polites, meaning citizens, or more plainly, people. So how can policymakers ensure they're considering people's response to this new way of getting around? It's maybe an obvious thing to consider, but that doesn't make it any less tricky.
When we think about policy and legislation and the sort of the needs of the people or the requirements of the population, it's really interesting, isn't it? I think certain parts of the population, perhaps me included, when we see new technologies, we just want to go and try them. You know, we're quite excited by these new things. And so there'll be certain groups of people, you know, we're not all going to be the same. There's going to be certain groups of people who are just going to want to go and use the new technologies. They're going to like the convenience. They're going to like the way that it fits within their lives. There's going to be other people who perhaps feel disadvantaged by this new technology or a little bit fearful of it, or, you know, quite like what they have today. They don't want the change. And the policy will be different for different people. So the more resilient of us to change in society, perhaps we may want more of the policy to help make sure that, for example, our data is governed really well, so that isn't misused. We've talked about safety, but safety is always, you know, being improved. That the journeys that are being offered through these new services are fair in terms of the prices we're paying. So we're going to find, as the services and the technologies come to market, we're going to see different voices, different lobby groups, I suspect, forming, who are going to ask and request different things from policymakers. So cyclist groups may have one particular voice. The auto industry may have a voice. The general consumer who is feeling their streets become, you know, too populated by these vehicles, or perhaps he's seeing the benefits because the streets are getting less populated, congestion is getting better. So as these things happen, there'll be different levers that will encourage people to write to their MPs, I guess.
For Richard, one of the best ways to gauge people's reactions is to involve them directly, as much and as often as possible.
London's Smart Mobility Living Lab is the first real big opportunity for us to gather the evidence that can inform policy based on the real world performance. So when we think about what our policy needs are, we actually need to see how these vehicles and technologies and new services are going to be used by people, what the challenges are going to be, what do you need in terms of permissions to get a vehicle onto the road and to use it in a way that makes sense for real people. So the Living Lab is going to generate the evidence for policymakers to say, well, you know, we do need safety standards, or perhaps, you know, these international standards are doing a good enough job. It's going to help us understand something about willingness to pay. So what people are going to want to pay for new services and how they are going to be interacted in a sustainable way with existing public transport. So our buses and our tubes in London and so on. That what we want is for all of these things to work together and to improve mobility within the city for everybody, not to introduce a non-democratic to have a new transport system. And so for all of those policy decisions, the trials that will be run in the Living Lab, they're generating the evidence, they're showing how these new technologies work and how real people use and interact with them. And that's going to be really, really valuable for the policymakers to understand what to do next.
Matthew Howard, founder and principal analyst at Assembly Research, says that involving citizens has already raised some interesting questions about morality.
A fairly big issue which citizens have wanted to get involved in, and this is the whole sort of morality around connected and autonomous vehicles. There is this sort of debate about whether or not, you know, the car should kill a elderly grandmother or a baby in the event of an accident, and a huge number of people have been taking part in simulations to help the industry learn about exactly what choices should be made. You know, more than 200 million people across 200 countries have taken part in this kind of work. But even the people who build that sort of caution that it shouldn't be down to sort of collective citizenship that these kind of things are determined by. It should still be somebody in some kind of a legislative position that makes the final call. So I think it's going to, you know, be a mixture of actors really coming down to it.
Researchers at Massachusetts Institute of Technology recently conducted a fascinating thought experiment of the kind Matthew describes. Millions of volunteers around the world were asked questions such as whether a car carrying an adult man, woman and child should swerve into a wall, killing them all, in order to avoid hitting three elderly people, and whether an unoccupied car should swerve and kill an unemployed adult man in order to save a child and a cat. The results revealed interesting cultural distinctions. For instance, in the global South, young people's lives are valued over the elderly. In the Far East and the Islamic world, however, this preference of young over old was not nearly so strong. Studies like these raise plenty of questions of their own. For Assembly Research's Matthew, they also highlight both the difficulty and the importance of getting citizens involved in shaping policy. He believes that CAV presents a particularly interesting case in this regard.
I think getting citizens involved is a difficult problem that policymakers face historically across a whole range of different issues. I suppose this one is slightly different in that, you know, more of us have experience of being in a vehicle, either owning one or driving one or being a passenger in one. It touches, you know, many more people, and people are also famously very, you know, protective about their vehicles and their ability to drive. So I think that the fact that it's going to change so much behavior will sort of empower people to get involved with trying to, you know, direct exactly how it looks and it works. And we've seen an extent of this with the way that companies like you know, Uber have come in and changed what was a familiar service for people, as in taxis. You know, people have got generally a view as to whether or not that's been a good or a bad disruption, and, you know, we've seen people take part in demonstrations and marches against those changes. So I suspect there to be you know, a similar level of interest at a citizen level about the way that this is going to change something they do so regularly.
And if studies like MIT's can teach us anything, it's that different people in different places will always have varying approaches to any complex issue.
I think it's not going to be any one actor in any one place, because we've already got some very different things emerging in various parts of the world. You know, if you look at China, you look at the US, and you look at parts of Europe, you've got a different picture emerging. If you look at it from an automotive point of view, you've got in the US, people saying that, you know, we need 5G to enable driverless cars, whereas in China they're just building the cars and worrying about the connectivity later. And you've got you know, manufacturers like Audi in Germany saying, well, we don't know what we're going to do yet, we're going to wait and see.
So it sounds like CAV policy will be fought out in the unique collective tussle of democratic decision making.
It's true. I think there are obviously already initiatives underway at a European level. There's a European group that has been looking to develop guidelines for how this will work. But that is not an easy process, and there's already been quite stiff opposition from a number of countries. Spain, in particular, and Sweden have been vocally against this sort of European approach. They even challenged the sort of legality of the EU getting involved in this way and abusing its position to force through this legislation. But I think it is going to require somebody from a higher level, such as the EU, to push through something which can then be adopted at a member state level, at least for some of the issues which involve international borders and boundaries. Because only when you sort of get it to that level can we then start talking about replicating it in other blocks around the world. And that will, of course, help the manufacturers that will need to have that sort of commonality in place. But of course, you know, there are issues which are much more local, to do with things like recharging of vehicles and parking and the sensors that must go on the traffic lights. You know, these are things that are going to be decided at a local government level rather than through the EU. And so I suspect, you know, we have already seen bodies set up by governments in various countries to start looking at those exact issues.
Ultimately, like Richard from TRL, Matthew sees this as a gradual process. It'll also be one that inevitably involves a degree of trial and error.
The idea of pulling this all under one umbrella, a piece of legislation, would perhaps seem the, you know, the most sensible and in a way straightforward to do, because you can sort of design it from scratch from start to finish. I think the reality, of course, is that there are many different pieces of legislation that are intertwined with others, which would also then need to be ripped up and reviewed and re-implemented, which sort of makes that approach, I think, less likely in this scenario. I think what we're probably going to see is an evolution of various pieces of policy and legislation to reflect the changes that are happening. I don't think this will be a big bang incident. You know, we won't one day wake up and the streets will be littered with, you know, driverless and autonomous vehicles. This is going to be something that will be happening slowly, because people need to get used to it as a concept as well, and people generally resist any kind of big change. So I think a sort of evolutionary approach is probably the one that we'll see play out.
So, how do you legislate for connected and autonomous vehicles? If we've learned anything from trying to answer this month's question, it's that policymakers have a lot to consider, from core concerns like safety and liability, to international borders, insurance, data protection, and of course the nuts and bolts of how all of this is actually going to work in practice. It's a mammoth task. And it's encouraging to see that governments worldwide are already taking it seriously. If Matthew and Richard are right, we're likely to see CAV policy evolve gradually and perhaps eventually being governed by some kind of global framework. To reach that point, it's possible we'll see more innovative approaches to legislation too. And Ben Gardner, the lawyer from Pint St Mason's, will be keeping an eye out for new laws written with tech trials in mind. What we do know for sure is that with each question answered, more new ones will arise. And of course, we'll be on hand to help answer them each month. Make sure to hit subscribe if you want to join us. You'll find Journey Makers wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you've got a big question that you'd like us to tackle in another episode, then send us a tweet at @SMLL_London. Until next time, see you in the future. How will you be getting there?